From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, money going out to businesses in the form of refunds, but not a penny coming into the state treasury thanks to old business tax credits.
As long as those credits are out there and the companies can claim them, they will claim them. So it's think of it as a hangover effect.
Student performance in Michigan dropping like a stone.
We're seeing it across the state, and we're seeing it across every socioeconomic group. So even higher income students have fallen significantly behind.
The teacher who traded dreams of acting in New York for 40 years of teaching Detroit high schoolers.
To be able to touch lives daily in a positive way, I think is the reason that we're all here.
And Mitch Albom on his new play, Hockey, the Musical. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's K-12 students are among the weakest in the country, and they're falling even further behind. Coming up, a new comprehensive report on just where things stand with public education in Michigan. But first, it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Housen. Let's start out right here, Daniel. We've learned the state treasury will be paying more in refunds to businesses under the old Michigan business tax than it's going to get from businesses under the new corporate income tax. Lansing is projecting a net loss of $99 million in revenue from business taxes. Was this expected?
Yeah, I think it was expected. I mean, these bigger companies like the automakers have large tax credits that they've been able to cash in. There are some limits on them going forward. But the positive sign of this is this means that the jobs that they said they were going to create, they actually created. So there are actually men and women who are in jobs that are paying income taxes and other kinds of taxes. But that said, the companies are able to take certain kinds of deductions, which means that taxes they're actually paying are less. I think this is going to be a political issue in an election year. I don't think there's any question about it. This is going to cause people to say, well, look, business isn't paying their fair share. They're not going to get into the weeds and into the details. And when Republicans who back some of this stuff maybe push back, people will just say, all I know is that the companies aren't paying taxes.
Could it be that in trying to get rid of that program that was used under Governor Engler and Governor Granholm, so getting rid of those tax credits, did we go too far in the opposite direction?
I don't know if it's a question of going too far. It's a question of living through the transition. I mean, as long as those credits are out there and the companies can claim them, they will claim them. So it's think of it as a hangover effect. I think that's probably a better way to think of it. You know, in public policy, things don't stop on a Friday and start on a Monday. I mean, they tend to phase in and phase out, and it takes. And so you live with the consequences of your predecessors sometimes throughout your entire tenure, which is I think going to happen with Rick Snyder.
Okay, let's talk some other stories, Daniel. We hear Dow Chemical is being wooed by other states who would just love to land those thousands of jobs. And this comes just 5 months after Dow announced that it's merging with DuPont. Latest findings from the Education Trust Midwest that show Michigan students are on their way to 48th place in the nation by 2030, rather than the hoped-for goal of being a top 10 education state. By the way, we'll have more with them later in this show. And I saw in today's Detroit News that Detroit's population rank is now at its lowest since 1850. So for the first time since before the Civil War, Detroit has fallen out of the ranks of America's top 20 cities.
Well, I think you have to unpack it a little bit. You know, in terms of education, I mean, they're spending a lot of time, and I've been one of the proponents of saying that Michigan needs to really fight hard to be the intellectual center of the 21st century auto industry, particularly as you see this convergence between Detroit and the auto industry itself and Silicon Valley. I don't know how you're going to make that argument when you're reading the educational attainment of fourth and eighth graders is dropping like a stone. You look at this report you're talking about, and what's particularly alarming to me, I think, is that white students in the last dozen years, their achievement has dropped even more precipitously than Black and Latino students. So this whole notion that minority kids are worse off than white kids in terms of educational attainment is not borne out by this study. So I think that's point one. In terms of Detroit population, I was thinking about this today after I read the story. What's more important, to be in the top 20 or to actually have a functioning city that can deliver services and actually is getting more people moving in, as I think we're starting to see anecdotally? You know, it reminds me of the debate we had with the auto companies back when they were fighting for market share all the time, but they continued to lose money. You know, what's more important, to be profitable or to say you've got 30% market share? I think we've finally come to the realization that profitability is more important than size. And I would say that in terms of how people look at Detroit and do I want to invest there, I think they're far more interested and would be far more interested investing there in 2016, 17, and 18 than they would in 2008, 9, and 10.
What about this, what we've heard about Dow Chemical being wooed by other states who would just love to get it out of Midland? What does that say to us?
Well, number one, it's not surprising. I mean, I think I was reminded of what happened with Delphi in 2005 when they declared bankruptcy. Governor Granholm issued a screaming statement. I still have it in my files that sounded as if it had been written by Solidarity House and the United Auto Workers. And while she was making a big deal out of what Delphi was doing, the governor of Indiana was quietly wooing the CEO of Delphi. They had operations down there in Indiana, and he was essentially trying to say, listen, if this governor up there doesn't like you, we'll take you. And that happens all the time. So it's not at all surprising to me that other states would be trying to make a play for some of the operations in Midland. I think the bigger question is, how effective and prepared is Michigan to fight back? Republicans in the legislature have gone after the MEDC, in part because of what we talked about at the top, because of some of the tax credits that became, you know, those chickens came home to roost, and it was potentially very expensive. And as a result, the majority was going after the MEDC. They cut their budget. They had to lay off some people.
Yeah.
You could almost say that they gutted the organization. So they don't have the tools that they might have had a few years ago.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with our weekly check-in via Skype. As always, great talking with you, Daniel. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Ernest Hemingway spent his boyhood summers here in Michigan and the last 20 years of his life in Cuba. So it is perhaps fitting that a Michigan company is overseeing a construction project at Hemingway's Cuban home, Finca Vigia. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton has this report from our Pure Cuba series on the Against the Odds race to save a Cuban and American treasure.
Ernest Hemingway's estate, Finca Vigia, is 10 miles east of Havana on a hill overlooking San Francisco de Paula. When we arrive, boys are playing baseball on the same field where Ernest Hemingway's sons played. The estate is in pretty good shape, unlike some of the historic sites in Cuba. A band plays traditional Cuban songs as we walk up the hill. Museum director Ada Rosa Alfonso Rosales greets us. She's wearing a turquoise linen pantsuit.
I love my work. Hemingway, all the time, love Cuba.
Her tour starts with the bell at the front entrance that so many people have rung over the years.
And I ring the bell for you.
Ernest Hemingway's widow, Mary, gave Finca Vigia to the Cuban government in 1960. The house is a time capsule. Everything is exactly as Hemingway left it the year before he died. Books, hunting trophies, even the half-drunk bottles of liquor on the bar cart. It's literary voyeurism at its best.
Hemingway normally wrote standing up and handwrite in his room.
But Finca Vigia and its treasures were in grave danger from decades of heat, humidity, pests, and neglect. That changed after Jenny Phillips paid a visit. She's the granddaughter of Hemingway's famous editor, Maxwell Perkins. The roof was in appalling condition.
The mold situation was incredible.
Phillips returned to the U.S. with a mission to save Finca Vigia. It wasn't easy. There was so much distrust.
The Cubans really closed things off, shut them down, didn't want the Yankees coming in anywhere or meddling or God forbid, taking anything.
And this project was a first. So the red tape in both countries was daunting. It took persistence, but eventually trust grew. The Americans consulted, the Cubans did the work, and together they saved the house. But the next big challenge was building something from scratch, and that's where the Cubans ran into trouble. The museum needed an archival laboratory on site to restore books, documents, and other precious artifacts. Ron Staley is with Christman, a Lansing construction company known for historic renovations. He says the half-finished structure was unsafe and had to be torn down. To an American eye,
they haven't built anything there for 50 years. And so the skill set to build has been lost.
So they took a new approach. Christman would assemble every single thing needed to build the lab and send it to Cuba in shipping containers in a kit, like a Sears Roebuck house. Manuals in Spanish would show Cuban workers how to construct the lab. Staley says every item, from screws to tools to masonry, had to be included.
If we are short one piece of pipe, they won't have the pipe on the island. It isn't like you can say, well, I'm going to run down to Lowe's to get it. It does not exist.
When Michigan Radio was in Cuba, workers were building a new administrative office with technical help from the Finca Vigía Foundation. But the first shipping container for the archive lab hadn't yet arrived. We followed up with museum director Ada Rosa Alfonso this week. It was more than a month later than expected, but she tells us the first container is finally sitting in Cuba's port of Mariel. Alfonso lapses into Spanish when asked how she feels. Basically, she's excited. When the container arrives at Finca Vigía, the seal will be broken and an inventory taken under the watchful eyes of a Cuban border official. The contents from then on will be kept under lock and key to deter pilfering. And the first American-designed, Cuban-built construction project in 60 years will be underway. I'm Tracy Samilton.
Mercedes Mejia contributed to this report. And you'll find a photo tour of the Ernest Hemingway Museum in Cuba. Just go to michiganradio.org. Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from a grant from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Let's pause a moment and consider one of life's culinary pleasures, mustard. Ah, but not just any mustard.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
You mean the mustard?
Yes, would you have any?
Would I? Or do I?
Both, actually.
Despite the aristocratic English accents in the famous TV commercial, Grey Poupon mustard is going to have a purely Michigan flavor. Owner Kraft Heinz has announced 100% of Grey Poupon mustard will be made at its plant in West Michigan in Holland. The white wine Dijon mustard will create 50 more jobs in West Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
Are patients dying from the care they're getting rather than from the disease for which they're seeking care? Well, that's a question raised by Johns Hopkins researchers in their just-released study that's been published in BMJ, formerly the British Medical Journal. Here's what they found. Medical errors cause 251,000 deaths every year in this country. That would put medical errors as the third leading cause of death, just behind heart disease and cancer, and ahead of respiratory disease and a host of others. The Johns Hopkins team is calling for the CDC to immediately add medical errors to its annual list reporting top causes of death. But is the study giving us the entire picture? Dr. Robin Hemphill is with us now. She directs the Veterans Administration's National Center for Patient Safety. Dr. Hemphill, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This is such a complex issue, but it's also a very emotional issue in the sense that it does touch everyone listening to us. And I'm sure you understand this study really got people's attention because no one wants to think that that physician or nurse might make an error that has a fatal outcome.
This article did get a lot of attention, and certainly it touches on something that every one of us, when we go into the health system, are things that we don't anticipate we need to think about, as in, you know, could an error or something untoward happen to us while we're under the care of some place that's supposed to help us? So this really was a big issue, although it's not the first time we've heard this either.
So in your experience, Dr. Hemphill, where do you believe the weak areas are in the entire process of patient going in, being cared for? What needs to be better and how?
Well, that's a big issue. And the article makes a point that we really only tend to track areas of inpatient harm. So there's these entire areas that we may not entirely understand yet, especially as we try to move more of our care into an outpatient realm. But at the end of the day, the healthcare system is very complicated. There's enormous handoffs, a huge amount of information, a fragmented healthcare system. So really ample opportunities for failures to occur. We bring in brand new medications. We bring in brand new technologies. We bring in brand new computer systems. We're doing surgeries that you couldn't have imagined years ago. Each one of those processes has a vulnerability in it, or a vulnerability in the handoff, or a vulnerability along the continuum of care. And that's why it is so difficult for us to entirely fix and get our arms around our systems. So rather than imagining we're going to fix one harm at a time, if we were to step back and say, we need to understand that people are human and they will make human mistakes, especially when they try to interface with complexity, a variety of patient needs that need to sometimes be unique but other times be standardized as they're trying to bring in and learn new procedures that can be life-saving.
And doing it under often very stressful circumstances or long, long hours on duty.
Exactly. So all of those things, each thing contributes to potential harms or the outcomes that we don't want. But imagine, think about this in your own life. We have built a car now that doesn't rely on you as the driver to be perfect and always make the right turn and always see the stop line. We understand that people will make mistakes for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they're being a little bit crazy and they're driving too fast. Other times they lose attention for a moment. Other times they just can't control that a deer runs in front of them. So we say, listen, driving is inherently unsafe, so let's design a car that is safe. That's where seatbelts came from. That's where airbags came from. That's how we design roads with lights and rumble strips across the side or guardrails. So we begin to think about our system and say, let's design it under the anticipation that patients are complex, have a bunch of needs. They will interface with providers who are also human beings with their own limitations, mixing in new technologies that are new, different, hard to work with. If we think about stepping back and designing things under the assumption that people are flawed, we might be getting to design things differently. And that's a major culture change.
And is that a culture change you think can or is happening in American hospitals and clinics?
I think that you're beginning to see some pockets of it. Certainly in the past, the Veterans Administration really talked about a culture of safety. This is a culture where we say, we won't punish people for making mistakes, for being human. We won't punish people for speaking up and saying, hey, I'm worried about this. And instead of saying, yeah, just work harder, don't worry about it, don't talk about it, to try and talk about our errors or our mistakes or our concerns. But we also have strong accountability principles. So in other words, if you have somebody who intentionally, repeatedly, just flaunts policies that are designed to keep people safe, you have to hold that person accountable. That's called a just culture. It's very hard to sustain. It's very hard to do it in any system because too often we just think that if we punish people for making a mistake, they'll remain attentive all of the time. If we just punish people and hold them accountable, and we do that across the health system, we somehow imagine that they'll suddenly be superhuman. What we recognize in the safety culture is even the most brilliant, dedicated, committed, passionate person is going to make mistakes sometimes. So let's build the system around that assumption rather than saying you must always be superhuman 100% of the time.
What can be done to bring patients and family members into the effort to cut medical errors?
What we're beginning to say and trying very hard to do is say, you know what, our patients, certainly in the VA, our veterans and their families need to be partners with us in their own health care. They're not passive. They cannot be passive. And yet you'll find it's very hard for a veteran or for a patient. I mean, imagine the times that you or a family member has been in the hospital. You're having some pain, you're worried about something, you want to ask for some help, but you're sort of like, well, I don't want to bother them, and maybe they'll think my question isn't helpful. And so we've been really, and you're seeing this in several areas, the Joint Commission has been trying to promote a campaign called Ask. In other words, you're a patient, ask what's going on, ask what's going to happen to you. In the VA, we've really tried to take that a step further. We have something called the Daily Plan. The Daily Plan is designed to allow a nurse to easily access what is supposed to happen to a patient in the hospital today. It creates a, essentially, here's the checklist. These things are supposed to happen. These are the medicines you should get. These are the x-rays or the tests. This is what we should achieve for you today. The nurse can then sit with the veteran and the family and go through that list of things. This is what should happen to you. This is your daily plan. This is your roadmap for what will happen to you today. And what that now allows is that the veteran or their family is very empowered at that point. You come in to give them a medication and they say, hey, I don't see that medication on my daily plan. Or they know that they're supposed to get a medication and now they can go out and say, I thought I was due a medication at this time frame. Somebody says, hey, we're taking you for a test. The veteran can say, that's not on my daily plan. Are you sure I'm supposed to get that test? So take that into any point where you're engaging with a medical system, whether it's in your doctor's office, whether you're getting a procedure described to you, you're going to come into the hospital and get surgery. As a family member and as a patient, you must be your own advocate in this system. It's complex. You cannot and should not assume that everything is going the way it's supposed to. If it doesn't make sense to you, ask, speak up. And more, we're trying to develop systems in the VA where not only can a doctor or nurse type in this was an error or a close call, we're hoping someday down the road that we'll be able to get the patients and their family members access to a little computer screen where they'd be able to type in, these are the things that I saw. Because the perspective and the vantage point that a patient has is very different. We get used to things in the hospital. We work there every day. We need their input, their engagement, and certainly we need people to be partners in their own health care.
Dr. Robin Hemphill directs the VA's National Center for Patient Safety. Dr. Hemphill, thank you so much for talking with us today on The Next Idea.
It was terrific to be here. Thank you for your time.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
A performing artist has big dreams of making it on a New York stage, but first takes a job as a teacher, just for a few years, just to get a little more financially secure before making that big jump to the Big Apple. But then that teacher falls in love with teaching, realizing the classroom is where you can have a powerful impact on so many lives. It sounds a lot like the film Mr. Holland's Opus, but this story is even better. This story is real life, lived over these past 40 years at Detroit's Cass Technical High School. Marilyn McCormick has anchored Cass Tech's Performing Arts Department since 1976. Marilyn's retiring at the end of this school year and doing it in style with a production of Tim Rice and Elton John's Aida, with two casts, one of just students and a second combining students with Cass Tech alumni. Marilyn McCormick, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so very much. It is such a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk with you.
And you actually first walked through the doors of Cass Tech as a 10th grader in 1969?
Yes. Yes, I did. My parents, we moved here from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And for some reason, it was recommended that I attend Cass and came into the business curriculum, as it were.
But it sounds like your heart was set on performing.
All the time, all the time. And they just said, well, that's something that you naturally do, and you'll go ahead and continue doing that, but you need to be able to do other things as well. As it turned out, I still am not able to do other things. this is all I do.
What brought you back then in 1976 as a teacher?
I had graduated from college and was married. My husband just got a job at Detroit Edison. And so our plan was to stay here in Detroit for about a year or so. And then we were going to try to move to New York and be artists because he was a singer. And I was into acting. And so we were just going to go and be like, you know, live that bohemian lifestyle. And what happened was my mom called me one day and she said she heard that they were hiring substitute teachers in Detroit. So I came downtown, here to Cass Tech, and I talked to my former principal and told him I was going to go and apply to substitute teach. And he said to me, don't worry, we'd like to keep you here. And he gave me paperwork. And I was hired that day in that moment.
And then your plan changed after you tried teaching. Why?
I was totally enjoying what I was doing. I had the opportunity to read with and to my students and to share that information. We were reading plays. We were talking about it. I was doing exactly what I wanted to do. So there was no real need, no necessity for me at that point to be looking to leave.
How would you sum up your feelings toward teaching, Marilyn?
I absolutely love it. I think it is one of the most beneficial ways to make a change in society, to be able to touch lives daily in a positive way, I think is the reason that we're all here. And to know that I have something unique to offer and that will change the way people think, feel, or even look at each other is inspiring for me. I hope that it is inspiring for them as well.
I'm sure it is a two-way street. You have had so many students go on to build careers for themselves in the performing arts, and it's clear that they keep you in their hearts as they do. We just spoke with actor J. Mallory McCree, who's a regular on ABC's Quantico, and he's got quite a list of credits on TV, films, and the stage. Well, we want you to listen because this is what J. Mallory McCree had to say to you.
Ms. McCormick, I love you for helping me understand that this business at large is a game, yet I have to always remember who I am and be secure in who I am to never lose my truth, but at the same time, always bring my best self and always be excellent in my craft. There's not much that I can control in this business of acting or the entertainment industry, but what I can control is always staying true to myself, keeping my integrity, and also making sure I bring the best work I possibly can every time I get the opportunity, whether that's an audition, whether I'm on stage, or whether I'm on set. It doesn't matter. Always bring my best self. Thank you, MC.
Well, I guess that's why you stayed with teaching all these years, Marilyn.
Yes, it is. That's exactly why. That's it. He summed that all up. Yes. And for him to be able to articulate that so clearly and so profoundly, that's exactly why I did it. So that he can go out and now he can teach someone else those things that he learned, he says, from me. Yes, that's why I stayed.
You know, Marilyn, it's certainly no secret that these are extraordinarily challenging times for Detroit public schools and for Detroit teachers. And I'm wondering, what would you say to someone at the very beginning of his or her journey as a teacher, especially in Detroit, or someone considering a career being a teacher?
I would tell them not to look to go into this for monetary gain, that the gain is something so much greater, that it is a personal one, and that they must be passionate about what it is they want to do. Knowing that they can change people's lives is something that can't be measured by a dollar. So stay in it. Hang in there. Plant those seeds, because that payoff is much greater than any amount of money that they could ever think of making.
And now this Thursday, Friday, Saturday of this week, your final production at Cass Tech. It's Aida. Tell us a little about Aida. You've got the two cast, and you're getting a chance to work one more time with some of your former students?
Yes. It's a dream come true. I have a former student of mine, Charles Coward. We've been in touch for many, many years. And when we saw Aida, I said to him then, that's the show that I want to do when I get ready to retire, because I think it's just so meaningful. The whole story of power versus passion and how people, in spite of things happening to them, can find their way through if they hold on to love, and that love does indeed conquer all. We were talking about my retirement and he said, I guess it's time. It's time for us to do the show. And so we started working on it. And it occurred to me, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to share our vision, this vision, with all of the students I've worked with in the past, so that my current students who are dreaming can work with people who are really in the business. They are on the stage, them working with people like Cornelia Smith, who's in Scandal, with Daniel Bellamy, who just did the movie, The Real MVP on Lifetime. They're on the stage with my girls are and guys are doing technical work with Charles, who has worked on shows at the Kennedy Center and the Lincoln Center. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So their dreams become real.
Well, it is, forget Mr. Holland's opus. This was Ms. McCormick's opus, Marilyn McCormick. We congratulate you on your 40 years and all of the lives that you have touched at Cass Technical High School in Detroit. Well done, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and come see the play, Aida. It's going to be special.
Up next, Mitch Albom on his new play, Hockey the Musical. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Up till now, when we talk with Mitch Albom about something he's written, it's a thoughtful conversation, reflective, exploring questions about life and death, like the first phone call from heaven or the magic strings of Frankie Presto. Mitch Albom is out with something new, and this time, no wiping away any tears. Opening tonight at the City Theater in Detroit is Mitch Albom's new play, Hockey the Musical. Mitch Albom, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I know when I first got wind, I heard Mitch is working on a musical about hockey, and I kind of went, what? So what was the thought process that got you going, hey, hockey players, singing, dancing, laughing, let's put this all together?
Well, a couple of things. First, I was a musician when I started, so it's not that big a jump for me to go to music. It's just about 25, 30 years too late. But I always sort of had a musical in the back of my head to try at some point in my life. And of all the sports that I've covered, hockey is the quirkiest by far, and the sweetest, and the most, I don't know, empathetic. You know, it's sort of the underdog sport of all the four big major ones in America. It's always last, and it's always fighting for attention. It goes years without a TV contract. You put people in penalty boxes where they have to sit like little kids, you know, when they do something wrong. They throw octopuses. You got people speaking Swedish and Russian and Finn in the locker room. So I always thought it was a pretty rich field for humor, and I've observed a lot of the humor in it. And then I think after doing Ernie, we realized that, you know, sports and theater don't have to be antithetical to each other. They can actually work. And I know that women tend to traditionally sort of go to musicals more than men. I'm not trying to be, you know, broad brush it, but I think factually that kind of is what they've observed.
Certainly worked in my life.
Yeah. And men are kind of dragged, like, oh, God, I got to see Cats, really?
No, Les Miserables, well, are you kidding? Yeah.
Yeah. So here's a play that not only has singing and dancing in it, you know, full Broadway quality type stuff. I hope people feel that way. But also a lot of sports jokes and a lot of local references and cameo appearances on the screen by real hockey players talking to the actors. So guys will definitely not feel like they were dragged to Spring Awakening or something like that.
Let's take a quick listen to a clip, and then we'll talk about the plot.
When you're a wing, you're a 3-1-3.
Say it loud.
Say it proud.
You're a man from the G.
Come on, y'all.
Octopus, oh octopus, to throw you I am wishing.
Oh octopus, oh octopus,
inside my pants you're squishing.
And any one of us who have been to the Joe to see that octopus get hurled out, we know how it got in there.
That's right. They hide them in their pants. Yeah, that's part of that. I guess that's a mashup of some of this song called When You're a Wing, which is sort of a takeoff on When You're a Jet from West Side Story. And it's gotten unbelievable response when we've done it, because, of course, it's like shooting fish in a barrel to do a song about the Red Wings. And it has a lot of Red Wing references. And we have these big video screens behind the actors. In fact, we really don't have a set. It's just a big wall of screens, and the screens keep changing constantly. And so there's a lot of footage of the Red Wings and dancing octopuses. And you know, it's very, very funny, and it gets a big rousing cheer at the end because everyone feels like they're sort of rooting for the home team.
And the whole idea is what? God says we got to get rid of a sport?
Yeah, so the premise is basically it starts very majestically. You know, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth, and he created man, and then man, with all this beauty in the world, created sports, you know, and then it shows how man created 8,000 sports. And so the premise is that God decides that man has created too many damn sports, and one needs to go because he needs to teach him a lesson. He considers sending a flood, and then he says, nah, he already did that, so he'll just send an angel down to eliminate a sport. Angel comes down, arbitrarily picks hockey off a list. A fan jumps out of the audience and says, not hockey, oh my God, not hockey. He's got a Stanley Cup on his head at the time. And he says, you know, anything but hockey, it's the greatest sport in the world. He gets down on his knees and he pleads with God, you know, if I can find 100 pure hockey souls, will you save the sport? And God says, find 5, you're never going to find 100. And he says, okay, 5. And then he conjures up 5. He thinks he's conjuring up Wayne Gretzky and Stevie Eiserman and Terry Sawchuk and Don Cherry, all these famous people to help him argue, you know, the case for hockey, but the angel can't spell, and so he misspells every one of the names, and so instead of getting Wayne Gretzky, they get Dwayne Gretzky, an African-American guy who works in Bed Bath & Beyond, and instead of getting Don Cherry, they get Dawn Cherry, who's a hair and nail specialist, a female from Piscataway, and a bunch of other people like that, and he's stuck with them because he only gets to pick one team. So these 5 average folks who really don't know all that much about hockey, but it turns out they all have a little connection to it, have to make the case to save the game, and they have to score 10 points before the play is over, or God destroys hockey forever. And there's scoreboards that are hanging on the side. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous from top to bottom.
Too fun. And I thought it was pretty cool. I read your column on Mother's Day about the fact that you are collaborating with your brother, Peter, yeah, who has quite the theater and dancing resume.
Yeah, he, you know, the last time we were even in the same city was when we were like 21 and 20 years old, and then he went off to become a very successful dancer and choreographer. He worked with Alvin Ailey and the London Royal Ballet, and he lived in Barcelona and Amsterdam, and we've just never been in the same place. And over the years, as I've done things in theater or movies, I always ask him, you know, you want to do something? And he's always like, come on, I live 9,000 miles, I can't. And then I think after our mom passed away, maybe that had something to do with it, but I sent him the obligatory email like, okay, I know you're going to say no, but I'm just telling you I'm going to do a musical, and I have another director I'm about to hire, but in case you want to do. And he sent me back a note saying, well, I hope you're sitting down because I'm going to say yes this time. And he moved here from London for several months to live here and direct it, and it's been an indescribable joy in my 50s to get to work with my kid brother for the first time, and he's extremely funny and very talented, and he's made a really great show.
Hockey the Musical opens tonight at Detroit City Theater. That's the theater inside of the Hockey Town Cafe right next to the Fox Theater. It'll run for 5 weeks, and then Ernie comes back for a 6th season at City Theater and also around Michigan. Best of luck with Hockey the Musical, Mitch Albom.
Thanks.
Always great talking with you.
Yeah, me too, Cynthia. Thanks.
A year ago, the Education Trust Midwest laid out a goal to make Michigan a top 10 education state and do it by 2030. The latest report from this nonpartisan group finds not only are we no closer to that goal, Michigan's student performance is dropping like a stone. If nothing changes, Michigan's on track to fall to a national ranking of 48th place by 2030. Amber Arellano of the Education Trust Midwest is here now to talk about this latest report. Just how is Michigan falling even further behind other states?
A year ago, we were really kind of taking a look at what will it take us to become a top 10 education state. You know, for many of us that grew up in Michigan, we prided ourselves in having great public institutions, including great public schools. And we were, you know, at least average, if not above average, compared to other states around the country. And when we looked out, you know, it was clear that we had a lot of catching up to do with leading education states around the country. And what's happened is that we have indeed fallen farther behind. We were projecting last year that if we didn't really change our policy and practices to be more thoughtful and research-based, that white students in Michigan would become 49th or 50th in the country in the next 15 years. We're actually reached that bottom, which I hope is the bottom, in 1 year. We're now ranked 49th in the country for a key indicator, including fourth grade reading. So That's a pretty startling decline, and I think it goes really kind of in the face of one of the conventional wisdoms in Michigan that our education problem is really kind of centered in urban areas or in really high poverty neighborhoods. And the truth is all of our students are falling behind other states around the country.
In fact, I know your report says new data suggests Michigan is witnessing systemic failure across racial and socioeconomic groups. So we're seeing this across the state?
We're seeing it across the state, and we're seeing it across every socioeconomic group. So even higher income students have fallen significantly behind their higher income peers in other states. The conventional wisdom in Michigan for decades has been, well, if I can get my child into a good suburban public school, everything will be fine. And maybe that's true in some cases, but the truth is in order for us to be a great state, we've got to keep up with the rest of the country and the rest of the world. Our kids are competing against the smartest kids in the world. Now, it's not just whether my kid can get into Central Michigan or whether, you know, or Michigan State or the local community college. I mean, there are talented young people from all around the world now coming to Michigan universities. And so we've really got to focus on really getting smarter and much more research-based on how we do public education in our state.
Which leads to why? Is it a matter of money? Is it quality of the teachers or the caliber of the leadership, either at the local level or in Lansing?
When we look at leading education states, we can see kind of a common set of strategies and practices that they've adopted over the last 15 years. And many of those practices we are simply either not doing here or we're not doing them well. You know, we can say pass bills or we can invest dollars into improvement strategies, but if they're not implemented well, things are not going to go right. We're not going to see the gains in our schools that we need to see. So just a quick example, every leading state in the country was really committed early on in their transformation process to raising their performance standards for teaching and learning. We're just starting to do that. In a state like Massachusetts, they did that almost 20 years ago. We're just doing that. We're in the first couple of years of that implementation, but we're already talking about getting rid of the most honest and important data that we can have, the state assessment that we have now that tell us how we're doing against those benchmarks. If we don't even have honest information about how we're doing against those higher performance standards, it's really difficult for schools and educators to know, am I reaching this new goal? How do I calibrate my instruction in order to make sure that I'm really teaching my kids at this higher level of learning.
Are you talking about the whole controversy about no more MEEP? We've got Common Core. What are we going to have? Okay, now we're going to do MSTEP. Now we're not. Is that all part of this?
Exactly. Exactly.
And whose fault is it?
I don't know if it's a fault, but certainly there has been this continually sort of shifting of strategy and the net effect.
Hasn't that been led by the legislature?
Well, that, and I mean, there's been other state leaders and other branches of government, too. The Michigan Department of Education plays a really important role in providing leadership on these issues. If our state continues to try to, you know, make changes in these things right when we're starting to get momentum on what is arguably the most important transformation strategy that the state has, that's been proven, that's research-based in every leading state in the country, and we're continuing to shift, it really feels for many educators on the ground and for many families that they're being jerked around. It's not one individual branch of government, right? But it's just the net effect of many different sort of changes that can happen over time.
We're talking at a time when the state legislature and our top state policymakers have to figure out where are we going to find the money to keep Detroit public school doors open, Flint water issues, and are all of those needs, those big expensive big ticket needs, going to draw resources away from school districts elsewhere in the state?
It's not clear, and I think there's going to be a lot of continued conversation over the next month about how all of that's going to come together. I do think the Detroit conversation in particular highlights sort of these underlying structural challenges that we have as a state. We're often reacting to the latest calamity or the latest emergency, but there are these really deep underlying issues going on, like a very inequitable funding formula. We're now in the bottom 10 states in the country for having one of the most inequitable funding formulas in the country over years and decades. That does have an impact on school districts that are facing sometimes significant legacy debt. They have high need students. Many of their students are coming to K-12 with a lot of needs, and they need more resources, and we need to be investing in those students. They need it. Our state needs it. We need every student in our state to be a top 10 student, or in other words, performing and learning at top 10 state levels, because this is really not only about them fundamentally, it's about their life opportunities. opportunities and ensuring that they have access to the best jobs and family-supporting jobs for their lifetimes. But it's a huge talent issue in our state. I mean, we're facing a talent crisis if we're not preparing kids and our young people to compete against the rest of the world. We can't attract the best employers and best companies around the world if we don't have a high-caliber workforce.
I'm a parent. I hear what you're saying. I want my kid to be in a top 10 school, and I want my kid to be a top 10 state performing student. How does an individual parent have any say-so in the kinds of things that happen in Lansing, decisions that are made? How do I help? What do I do?
At the micro level, I mean, yeah. I think we all know as parents, what are the things that we do day-to-day? Being in touch with the teacher, supporting our children as we can, because all of us have, you know, different sorts of challenges with that. With homework, being on top of the homework, being aware of what's going on in terms of your local school district or in the state level conversation. But in terms of the macro level, certainly, I mean, as a mom, and I have a four-year-old, in my personal role, that would be difficult to have a real voice in the state-level conversation in terms of public education. So we are trying to provide more opportunities for more stakeholders around the state to have a voice in that. And we invite people to be part of that conversation. They can go to MichiganAchieves.com. We have letters that they can send to key leaders on particular topics. They can sign up to get more information. I mean, just being informed in the conversation is really important because a lot of this, as you know, it's often changing now by the month, if not by the week. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much going on in education right now, and it's all hugely important. I mean, something as simple as a state assessment, that might not sound that important, but the truth is that if we don't have a high-caliber state assessment, we won't know how we're doing compared to other states around the country, and that's partly what got us into this mess. We didn't know for many, many years because we were using an outdated state assessment. We just didn't know that we were falling behind the rest of the country. We had low standards. And when we expect not a lot from our kids, that's what they deliver. And we've gotten low achievement for that.
And here we sit at 49 out of 50.
And here we sit. We have to have an honest conversation, and that starts with honest data. It starts with honest comparable data on how we're doing against these new benchmarks. We're never going to change if we're not really being honest with ourselves about how we're doing against those kind of benchmarks.
So what's the recommendation that you've got from the Education Trust Midwest? Where should we be?
Well, we need to make sure that we stay on track with these new higher performance standards for teaching and learning. And we've got to make sure that we're getting honest data about how we're doing compared to other states around the country against those benchmarks. One of the other things that we should be doing over the next couple of years is really ensuring that all of our educators are being properly supported to reach those new performance standards. Frankly, it's just not acceptable and it's not fair to educators to not be providing more of that kind of support and training. And to give a sense of what that kind of implementation looks like in Michigan compared to a leading state. Tennessee is now one of the highest growth states. If you look at the data over the last several years, one of the highest growth states in the country for student achievement. In 2003, they were underperforming Michigan. Today, they're truly on target to become a top 10 education state in the next several years. So we can learn a lot from them. When they implemented new performance standards, they invested significantly in making sure every teacher in their state had been trained on those new standards. They trained more than 30,000 teachers over 3 years. I mean, that's great leadership. You know, we invest in what we care about and what we value. And we're not valuing our teachers and our principals enough. I mean, if we really, really value them, and we should be because they're arguably the education system's greatest asset, right? One of the state's greatest asset, we would be investing more in that kind of support. So those are the kinds of great practices that we should be incorporating in our state. When we're serious about change, that's the kind of practice that we'll be seeing here.
Is there any good news in the report? Is there anything that's been done right or that is promising?
We have been starting to put into place some really significant investments and some significant commitments to change. For example, the legislature last year invested about $25 million in becoming top 10 state, starting with third grade reading. This year, they're considering making another pretty significant investment. That's a really smart investment. If we're going to start somewhere in terms of becoming top 10, that's where we should start. If we're now at the bottom 5 states in the country for third grade reading, let's start there. We know if kids are on track to read by third grade, they're much more likely to succeed in K-12 and to graduate from high school. We just have to make sure that we're spending that money wisely.
And again, the website for people who want to find out more is MichiganAchieves.com. Amber Arellano of the Education Trust Midwest, always great to talk with you. We certainly understand what's at stake if this doesn't turn around.
Thank you so much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Mercedes Mejia, Daniel Razel, Lindsay Scullin and Kate Summers. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.